Hello, and welcome to the Screen Composer Studio, a podcast about the musical storytellers behind some of your favorite films, shows, video games, and more. I'm your host, Adrian Ellis. Donald Kwan sees his whole life, including his career and businesses, as an improvisation. As a composer, he is known for his work on shows such as Relic Hunter, Mutant X, and APTN's Moccasin Flats. As a musician and recording artist, he has toured with Lorena McKennitt and Lighthouse, and recorded his own music at Peter Gabriel's iconic Real World Studios. His own studio, the incredible Q Music, once housed over 400 indigenous instruments from six continents, and he has collaborated with groups such as the Toronto Tabla Ensemble, Samba Squad, MDO Catholic Toronto Dance, and First Nations choreographer Sandy Smith. Back in 2007, I was lucky enough to spend time as Donald's apprentice, and throughout this conversation, I recount memories of that challenging and formative time, and get to thank him for being a big part of my development as a composer and creative person. We talk about his growing up in Toronto as the only Chinese-Canadian kid in his school, his early start in music, and how he ended up at the nascent film scoring program at Berkeley. There, he learned the traditional techniques of pen and paper scoring, as well as the old-school analog methods of syncing music and picture. It was, however, his interest in the emerging use of computers and music that would help him stand out and get him his first breaks in the industry. During a performance in 2009, Donald suffered a near-fatal stroke and was without vital signs for nearly 20 minutes. He miraculously survived, but would spend weeks in a coma, after which the long journey toward recovery began. Now, over 10 years later, I help Donald restore some of his memory as I share stories of our time together. Hey, would you do me a favor? If you enjoy this show, would you post about it on your socials or email a friend about it? That would be a huge help in helping us share the stories of these amazing creators. And now, please enjoy my conversation with a truly singular Donald Kwan. Donald, welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So we have a bit of shared history. I spent some time with you back in 2007, about 6 weeks.
2007. Wow. I don't have any the years in my brain. So
yeah, well, we'll revisit all that. that's sort of the reason why we're going through this, because, I'm going to prompt you with a few things and hopefully that'll bring some memories up for you. And, it's going to be a fun way to work through this, because we do have this shared history together. And I think that's going to be a neat way to move through this. The first time I ever met you, after we were paired through the Screen Composers Guild, I got to visit you at your studio in 401 Richmond. And for those of you who don't know, 401 Richmond is a refurbished tin factory from way back in the day, a giant, beautiful brick building that houses all these makers and creators and, artists of all types, and even legal people and computer developers and everything else. And it's just one of the most inspiring and creative spaces I've ever been in. And you had your studio in the basement, and that studio is still there. Q Music, Q as in Kwan, which I always thought was a very clever double entendre that really worked for what you were doing. And walking into that space was another wow moment, because it wasn't just one studio room and a tracking room. It was this whole kind of experience of a space. You had not only the tracking room or the tracking floor and the control room, which was all beautiful with the speakers up on these sort of like chrome rebar explosion. And then you walk through a narrow thing, you had the tracking room. Then you had this whole event space, this massive black curtained off velvet curtains, this huge Buddha head, all these, like a big grand piano. And then you had this incredible theater space, like a little place where you could watch like a little mini cinema inside this whole space. That's a whole setup for this question, which is basically, how did that come to be? Because that was a complete jaw dropper for me, and just such an inspiring space. How did that place in 401 Richmond come to be?
Well, it's really due to 401 Richmond. I was one of the first tenants at in the building. So the building was bought by a kind of a famous architect named Eberhard Zeidler. He built Ontario Place or something like that.
Okay.
Science Center. I'm not sure. Like, don't quote me on that, but it's something like that. He built a bunch of the epic Toronto landmarks that we know. Anyways, so he bought this a bunch of buildings that were slated to be demolished, and he just bought them up. They weren't even zoned at that time. He just bought them up. He said, "We can't have these buildings be torn down, so I'm going to buy them." And he bought, I think, 4 buildings and gave each one to his architect daughters to run and to roll with. And they all basically took a building each, and they turned it into the Gladstone Hotel as one of them, 401. There's others, but it's that kind of thing. So when I first moved in, I was looking for a place because I was just about to grow. So I had hired a full-time person for Q Music, and I didn't have a place. So I just, you know, did the Now ads and walked around the neighborhood, and we wandered into this place, and it was empty, basically. Huge building, no infrastructure. I ended up taking it and meeting Margie, who was in charge of 401, Margie Zeidler. Meeting her was just wonderful because she's a true artist. And she allowed me during that time, prior to zoning, prior to anything, they were just saving this building. She just said, you know, come here for a year, and if you have some ideas, sure, just do it. And I said, I have all these ideas. She said, you know, the rent's not going to be any cheaper. That you can't get any cheaper rent than here, because we're right in the middle of the worst part of town. At the time, Queen and Spadina was the dregs. There right. was nothing here.
Wow.
Not a restaurant within walking distance.
And now it's one of the most hyped places, I think, going at all. Like, it's so hot there now.
Well, so I grabbed the cheap rent. I said, okay, let's do it. And my mind just started exploding with all these ideas. And so over the next couple of years, I managed to do enough projects and took enough spaces down there that Margie was happy leasing me a third of the basement.
Wow.
And said, go for it.
Wow.
And I went for it and I haven't stopped. So I've been there 26 years or so.
Amazing. Yeah.
And I've had probably 12 tenancies in the building over the 26 years. And you name it, I've had everything here. From corporate offices to recording studios to world music concert venues to music stores, and the list goes on. Oh, I actually had a graphic studio in here, a video editing studio in here for a while. And so the building has allowed me to express my creative vision, because, you know, getting a space in downtown Toronto is virtually the hardest thing that a person can deal with who's trying to grow their creative business.
Mm-hmm.
Just the rent, just getting it, getting rent, finding it, like, let alone in downtown Toronto, like right in the core.
Right.
So thank God I nabbed all of that before this was an area anybody wanted to be in. Like, literally, I would tell my friends, oh, I'm renting a place in Queen and Spadina. And they go, are you nuts? Why would you do that? There's nothing there and it's dangerous. And I just said, I don't care. They're letting me build whatever I want in there. And I'm going to go for it.
Did you have a sense of where it was going? Did you see? Okay, so you didn't see where that part of town was going, and that eventually it would be prime real estate, amazing restaurants, everything within walk. Like, you've got Chinatown, you've got downtown, you've got the core Eaton Center, all this stuff so close.
Well, what happened was that I didn't have a vision of it, but, you know, I'm here every day, all day long. Like, I never lived here. I live here now because I'm a superintendent, but I never lived here. So every time I would come to work, I would just see another thing pop up, and over 20 years.
Wow.
I see it grow little by little. And I could have moved out after the first year.
Yeah. What year was that when you first moved in?
I'm guessing now. I would guess it's about 1990.
Oh wow. Okay. Right. Yep. So by you the know, time it, by the time
it might
I visited
be 92.
Okay. Yeah. In that area. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. So, but Toronto has been your home your entire life. You were born in Toronto. Is that right?
I was born in Toronto. My parents were born in, my dad was born in Toronto. My mom was born in New York. So I'm of a very small generation, like a second generation Chinese Canadian. So I almost knew everybody who was of my generation. All the families were tied together.
Right.
They all knew each other. So in terms of, you know, I've only spoken English. My dad only spoke English. My grandparents came when they were, you know, in their 20s.
Wow.
We were the first wave. Huh. Like all the Chinese, virtually all the Chinese people I know now, are one generation newer than my family.
So there was no Cantonese or Mandarin spoken at home even?
No, my mother and father both did speak it, but they didn't speak it at home because they wanted us to be so. You can imagine, like I was the only Asian. I was the only Asian kid in my school for up until seventh grade.
Okay, wow.
Eighth grade.
Yeah.
So imagine that, like there was one black guy, and me. We're the only visible minorities in our entire junior high.
And that's ironic now, of course, because Toronto's seen as the multicultural hub of Canada where it's just a big mix of everything. But you're telling me that you were really just, you know, on the outside, even though you probably spoke without any accent, you were as Canadian as pretty much everyone else. What was that experience like? What was it growing up in that kind of environment?
I ran with it because my mother, she was beautiful. She had the right idea. She never negated our Chinese experience, but it was like, keep it under wraps, man. Like, you know, just like be Canadian.
Right.
You know, I love Betty Crocker and watching Miss America. Like, that's what she, that's the only thing she would tell her friends. All of the Chinese-ness was not talked about, and it wasn't hidden, but it was just didn't mention it. And because our family comes from the north of China, so we don't have a typical Chinese look. So we can actually pass for, like, people wonder if we're Latin sometimes or Aboriginal, like, you know. So we use the hat. Mm-hmm. As a family, we used that to get through life before the waves of Asian immigration. You know, there's been decades of other immigration, but no one notices when the immigration waves change from Polish to Irish,
right,
to Russian. But when Chinese came, it was like, these people are different.
And did things change at that point for you?
No, because I was so, our family was assimilating so long. My dad was beat up because he was the only Asian in his school. So he had a whole entire life and he never got around that.
Hmm.
We were the future. My brother and sister were the future to be Canadian and to not let anybody know we're Chinese.
Mm.
We were the ones to do that.
Mm.
My mother wanted nothing but to be totally American. She didn't want anything to do with it. And she made a point to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it took over her personality. And my dad was similar. My dad was poorer. So that was something that was on top of all of that stuff.
Right.
They had lots of kids and they were extremely poor. So.
Yeah. How does music enter the picture? When does that happen? And what's your in with that? What did you get into? How did you start playing?
It really started with my mother and kindergarten.
Okay.
And the TST DB, or at the time, just the school board, the Toronto School Board. Believe it or not, back then, music was considered a really, really, really important thing to teach kids.
Okay.
And so the exact more money was given to the music program than the sports, than anything, academics, anything. It was valued. Whoever was the chairman of the school board at the time was a visionary. I don't know any history of that, but I know from my experience. So my mother, being the wanting to be Canadian person, sent all of us kids off to piano lessons when we were 7 years old with the old piano teacher down the street. Like, she was literally old. She was 80 at the time when I started, when I was 7. And totally straight ahead conservatory Canadian piano teacher. And I just went by rote. No, I didn't like music per se, but I just went because eat your dinner and go to piano lessons. Okay, you just do it.
Right.
So I was basically followed my mom's mother's instructions for all of my childhood. So I continued piano lessons up until I was 12 years old.
Right. Good student?
15. Was I a good student?
Yeah.
No, I was the worst student, but I was brilliant. Okay. I have to be proud of it. So I finally realized I was good at music. But kind of kept it to myself because, like, what's it going to do me, right? Who cares? But I had a really good ear, and music came naturally to me. So what I would do was pretend I was learning in class. I already knew everything. I just listened to something. I know how it goes. So, like, so I just went to, you know, the lessons and did the exercise. So I, you know, teacher goes, okay, let's. I want to hear you play your song, your piece, your Mozart for this week's lesson, and I would just like remember it and play it by ear. Like, I had no idea what the notes. I just played it by ear, and because that old music teacher was so old school, she didn't even know the concept of improvising or winging it.
Right.
She only knew learning scales and then applying it by reading music. That's right. The only thing she knew. And I would go in and just go, oh, yeah, I know how that goes. And I would play it by ear. I wouldn't practice. I would just go, oh, yeah, I know how that goes. And I'd play by ear. And teacher would go, that's wonderful. Let's go into the next class. And I got through all of my theory, 5 years of piano lessons, and not doing anything.
Wow, you never got caught. It's amazing how often this comes up in conversations with composers, how they were poor students. By the way, if you can hear that noise in the background, we're just getting hammered with this massive rainstorm all of a sudden.
Oh, right, yeah. I heard
that. Yeah, they sort of faked their way, and I was the same way. I faked my way through all my lessons. I didn't like reading dots on pages, and I found it really it was an impediment to actually making music. And it confused my brain, and there was no one-to-one relationship, but I got caught because I would be playing something and the fingering would be wrong on the guitar. And you're right, like, well, let's take it from bar 54, note 5, like, you know, just like a beat before the bar, and I'd be like, oh, okay. And I'd be sitting there trying to figure it out. It became clear that I was not playing along with the rules. It's so interesting. Were you making your own music and writing your own songs and getting into your own kind of style of music that you like?
Not yet.
Yeah.
You know, that came later. So the big thing was that even though the piano playing part was, I faked it. I still went every time and I did the lessons. So without really knowing it, I did learn because it's so slow when the way they teach you. Yeah. It takes you 6 months to learn the keys, right? They just teach you a little slowly. Like what can a 7-year-old comprehend?
Yeah.
So they just taught me that. And eventually I got through the piano part. I would play, I would come in and play a rock and roll thing. And she would go, oh, well, let's try to find the music. And then I would go because I desperately I loved music. I loved music since I was 5 years old because my dad loved music and always had the radio on and we always sang the songs. And me and my brother and sister loved pop music of the 70s, loved it. Like it was everything. We would be singing Carpenters out loud. Like we knew all the lyrics. My dad would buy us the albums and the singles. You know, he was an artist. So that was the main thing he wanted to teach us. And we were okay. We were smart. We did math okay. We got C's. It's fine. Who cares? He wanted to buy, you know, one of the first presents. He just showed up one day and said, here, I got a record for you. It was the Beatles' I Am the Walrus.
Oh, wow.
A single.
Yeah.
I was probably 5 or 6 years old. Can you imagine?
So you're
back
what
to
was
your present?
What was your dad was an artist? Like what was his? Because this is sort of tying back to me now for the way that I sort of was introduced to you, or little unbeknownst to me, like I saw a very serious, very accomplished composer on your website before I came and visited. You know, I sort of researched those things, but the person that you are and how you move through the world was that was a wonderful surprise. And was also a very impactful experience for me, and we'll get into that. But was your dad kind of had that artist mindset? Because it doesn't sound like they really, your parents didn't pressurize you to like be academically minded and always hyper achieving and all this kind of stuff.
They wanted to go against every Chinese person was like smart in math and had and good do kung fu. That's the last thing my parents wanted us to be known for. All those
right.
things, which were negative, you know, that's how they fought racism. Not by kicking and screaming, but by showing people we're as Canadian as anybody. And if we can be artists, regular Canadians can't even be artists.
Right.
So my mom and dad just like loved it when we said we wanted to go into the arts.
They wow! Wow!
And my dad was saved because he got a job. Out of poverty, he went to OCA and told his parents he was studying engineering.
Mm.
And went to school for 4 years without telling his parents because they would kick him out if they said he was studying art.
Wow!
They would literally couldn't take it. So he had to literally lie for 5 years and said he was going to U of T for engineering. Yet he was going to OCA. And the day he told them was the day he won the Governor's General Award at OCA, the highest award in the school.
Wow.
He won.
Wow.
That's when he finally said, hey, guess what? I'm an artist. And, oh, yeah, I didn't want to tell you, but CBC just offered me a full-time job.
Oh, wow.
CBC, i.e. the government.
Right.
So he finally came clean when he could tell his parents, A, he won the highest award in the school, and two, he got a high-paying job at the CBC.
Wow.
So from there on, it just never stopped.
That's amazing. So he was passing on that gift to you, or in a sense doing what a lot of parents did was going, my child will never suffer the way I did. Under
exactly.
my parents' rule, yeah.
And my mother had her own story, very similar to my dad. So the combination of the two shaped me and shaped my brother and sister. You know, if you look at, if you ever research into what my brother and sister do, you'll see a very similar story in a whole different area. But the mindset where we were raised all the same way. Hmm. And we've all been inspirational to the people we've been around. And the idea of being mentors, I felt I was a mentor when I was 10 years old to my other classmates.
Right.
And I'm still friends with kids that I was friends with when I was 7. And they tell me to this day, I taught them about life and about stuff.
Wow, that's great.
And we're great friends today, 50 years later.
So you mentioned your dad wins the Governor General Award, and you ended up winning a scholarship or going to Berkeley on a scholarship for, I think it was viola performance. Is that right?
Yeah. So long story short, I studied privately, and my private teacher in Toronto was like a regular musician Joe doing, 12 music jobs just to make a living,
yeah,
including teaching and whatnot. He ended up being a pretty, good film composer in LA. But when he taught me, I went to him because his credentials said, specialist in jazz and music theater. I said, that's what I want to do.
Oh.
I find out many years later, he knew nothing about jazz or music theater. It was just the thing,
that's what everyone wanted.
Well, I can teach trombone. Let me figure out how to play it. Like, he was like that in music, and end up being one of my big mentors.
Hmm. When you're heading off to Berkeley on this scholarship.
Oh yeah, right.
And Berkeley. what was your conception of what that was going to mean? Did you have a destination in mind, like once I'm done Berkeley, then I'll do this, or did you have a kind of like perception of where you were going?
Nope, I had no mentors except that one. He was my only mentor at the time, and he got me to go to Berkeley. One beautiful thing he did was he recognized in me what I was capable of. He said, hey, there's nothing like being a composer for a living. Because he ended up making a living. Like, he only taught for a year, and then he went off and partnered up and started scoring stuff. So I didn't have any mentors at that time except one. And he identified me as, he goes, it's really cool to be a film composer. You can make a, decent living, blah, blah, blah. Little did I know that he was independently wealthy and he didn't know what he's talking about. But he told me, hey, being a film composer is really cool. You can do it. And I said, hey, okay. He goes, oh, you should go to Berkeley. That's where I went. My friend just started a film scoring program there. You should do it. So I did the whole process. My mother was so impressed with the whole idea I got into Berkeley and all that stuff. She basically said, here, all my savings, go to Berkeley.
Wow.
And back then, Berkeley was actually cheap.
Right. Yeah.
So it's nuts now. I say cheap, I mean it was the same price as if I went to U of T.
Right.
That's when I went to Berkeley.
Wow.
So, wow. My mother financed it, but it was doable, and she did use her life savings, but it was possible. I've probably mentored like 5 people to this point that would love to go to Berkeley, but there's no way unless they got a full scholarship. There's no way.
Yeah.
Who's gonna, like, you say, okay, I want to graduate from Berkeley. It's going to cost me $250,000. Like,
it's crazy. Wow.
So I was lucky. I did it. And I can say too, I kind of squandered it. Not in a bad way. I could have learned a lot. Berkeley was a jazz school at the time. The film scoring thing was just an idea at the time.
Ah, okay.
It was a
Sorry, just to stop you for saying, what year is this? Sort of put us in the place of where the technology and a film scoring sort of, and what you'd be learning at that time.
Okay, so for, in terms of films, I went to Berkeley in 1985.
Okay.
Around there. You know, it's all give or take a few years. But
right.
around 1985 is when I graduated from high school and I went directly to Boston.
So they're still using ClickBooks. They're still, it's
the
timers.
We didn't even have cell phones or ATMs. Like,
right.
the computer was not used in the regular person's life.
Right.
So this is older than old.
Yeah.
When I graduated, they still did not have a computer in Berkeley.
Wow.
I was in a work study program in my fifth year, and we finally got a synthesizer, a DX7.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
That's the year that after I graduated. So I learned the film scoring program was all manual with real players. The
wow.
concept of doing music on a computer was out, like, oh, are you out of your mind?
Mm.
You do music, you have people play, you write it down, and you hear how it sounds. That's how I learned film scoring. I would take music editing class, and we were had awls and 35 millimeter film, and we were punching holes in so they would go click, 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 click. And we'd have to sit there, like, we'd spent weeks counting, okay, I want a 135 click, so I have to do the math and then punch a hole every 172 frames. So I would make a click track, and that would take me like 2 weeks. So I punch the hole, count 135, punch another hole, punch another, each one for each click, each time go kick, each time.
Oh my God.
So I would do a 3-minute cue and make a click track that they would play on the machines, and they'd have all these projectors synced up with what happens is sync. This was sync then. No computers,
mm-hmm.
no electricity. Literally, you had a bunch of film camera projectors with a pole with a notch, and it goes into them like that. So when you turn the pole, all the projectors turn one frame.
Wow.
So you would shove these rods into the projectors, and that's how you got multi-track. If you wanted 8 tracks, you'd have to get 8 of these optical film projectors, and you'd have to transfer your audio from magnetic tape to mag. They call it mag. And it's basically film, but instead of pictures, it's a magnetic tape. And that's what, so that was one channel each, mono. So if you wanted 8 channels, you would have to get 8 of these projectors together with a rod that went through them so they would all sync together. And there would be little gadgets so that, you know, you could offset. The words come from all this, right? The words we use, offset, by taking the rod out, turning one of the reels and sticking the rod back in. Like, this is the world I learned film music from.
Did it seem horribly complicated and like a rigmarole at the time? Because it certainly sounds that way now.
No, because you have to remember, we couldn't even fathom that people would be using computers to do things.
Right.
If you told someone, hey, we're going to do our banking on a computer, people would go like, shut up. No way. What are you talking about?
Oh, that's true.
A phone in our pocket. Yeah, right.
Right. Not, and you don't use it to call anyone. That's the last thing you're going to use your phone for. I guess for me, it was sort of like the thing. I didn't study film composition, but I started on, you know, reel to reel on tape decks going back and forth, and then finally 4-track. And I mean, it's not as complicated as that, but certainly I remember when I first started using a digital audio workstation, like a computer, I just thought, this is magic. I mean, it's so, there's so many more possibilities. It's so much easier. It wasn't like, oh, this thing that I was doing before is hard. That's just the way it's done. But this new thing seems like, wow, you just have a wand and you can make things happen.
See, I started so early that it's all just a progression for me. It's right. Like, it's not one day, oh, we're using computers now. No, this is over 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
When I was 12 to when I was 17.
Yeah.
Over that time, the computer just started getting into use in regular things like people word processing and stuff. This was all brand new, but it was so slow, just like technology now. Oh, Apple announces something, it's going to be ready in 4 years. Like, that's the way it was for me with technology. Technology would come, but I'd have years to figure it out. And I'd sit at home, I had no social life, and I'd be there like learning every single thing about every new thing that came out and pursuing my childhood musical hobbies and stamp collecting. And because my dad was a graphic artist, he never touched a computer in his life.
Wow.
Graphic design means you take a X-Acto knife and you cut out little colored pieces of paper and you breathe on it and you stick it down, and then you can't even take a photocopy because the photocopier didn't exist. So you take a photograph of it, and then you would send the photograph to the processing lab, and a week later you would get the thing. That's how they did it. But they've been doing that for hundreds of years. They've been making movies on celluloid for hundreds of years. That's old technology.
Mm.
But what we take for granted now is really new, because I was there when we didn't do it. Yet I'm not the 80-year-old old guy who's like, oh, he's ancient. No, I brought to the seven people I apprenticed with, I brought technology to them, because none of them use computers.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. When you get out of Berkeley, what direction do you face? Do you face south towards Los Angeles, or you go east and north? Nope. Back to Toronto?
One thing that was clear, and this was given to me by my parents, we've made huge strides being Canadian Chinese. That's what we're going to be. And it was obvious to me that's what I was going to be. Because right. I saw how hard my parents were to achieve that. Be part of Canadian society without anybody even mentioning the fact that we were visible minorities.
Wow.
And I lived a life where it was never, ever, ever brought up. Forget about races on the street. It was never brought up because people were uncomfortable.
Okay.
I'm sure they all notice I'm the only Chinese composer in the business or assistant. And at the time, well, even now there's hardly any, but there's a good amount now. But back then, it was like when I was in school, I was the only Chinese kid all in my school. Well, I was the only Chinese kid who wasn't Chinese helping all these people. So no one would ever say anything about that.
Right.
But I knew it. I'm sure, like, you know, I'm being maybe racist myself, but I'm sure I got jobs because they thought that I could help them with the computers.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
They would never say that.
Right.
But I swear to God, that's why, like, sure, I'll pay you $25 an hour in 1982. Yeah, sure. We never talked about it, but I know.
Yeah.
A large part of it was because they thought I actually could help them. And it turns out I actually really did help them, because I was the first one to embrace personal computers in the production of music in the city.
Was that because did you see the opportunity, or were you just fascinated by what the potential
was? I was just fascinated.
Right.
I've never done anything because I saw the opportunity.
Okay.
Opportunities come because of what I do. That's yeah. how it works.
Yeah, you follow.
Not the other way around.
Right. You're following your interests and your curiosity. This podcast is brought to you by the Screen Composers Guild of Canada, celebrating its 40th year in 2020. The SCGC is a national association of professional music composers and producers for film, television, and media, whose mission includes promoting the music, status, and rights for film, television, and media composers in Canada. Special thanks to the SOCAN Foundation for financial support. For more information on the SCGC, please visit www.screencomposers.ca and follow us online at Screen Composers. And now, back to our show. You come back to Toronto and you're getting yourself established. What did those first few years look like? How did you, what was your sort of game plan? Or if you didn't have a game plan, what were you working
on?
Very simple.
So my teacher who got me to go to Berkeley. By the way, I was allowed, kind of not allowed, but everything was good about me going to Berkeley because I won this award that my teacher helped me get. Because my teacher actually taught me composition, some really good things. You know, I don't want to discount him at all. He taught me a lot about music. But he got me to go to Berkeley. And so when I came back from Berkeley, who was the first one there? He was still there.
Wow.
His proud student had finished Berkeley and now can know all this computer stuff. Where people still don't even connect computers and music together. Like, what is that?
Right.
So he was the first one I approached. And he had a lot of friends. Culturally, he's in a group of people who were, a lot of his friends were composers, were film composers. In LA, in Toronto, you know, it's the whole entertainment business. So when I came back to Toronto, he was the first one who gave me a job. And basically, because he knew me 5 years earlier, he knew what I was capable of, and I was the same person. So we kind of said, well, can do this. All of a sudden, I had a job. Amazing. Within 2 months, I was working for him and his friend, his partner. So I was working for them separately, doing gigs for him, because he had the special privilege of being my teacher for 7 years. But he had a business partner, so I started working for him. And then he needed something and said, hey, recommend it, because I was literally the only person who tied computers and music together. So all of these composers, this is probably a dozen of them in Toronto, all great composers, all working composers, doing tons of stuff, none of them had touched a computer.
Amazing.
They did it all by analog. And I just came in, and because I knew about film scoring, I knew about click tracks and punching holes, and I didn't have to teach me anything. So, well, I need a click track, and I need to change, and I need it by tomorrow. I said, it's no problem. Here, and there. I output the click track on my computer, mini click, because this was before digital recording, right? This was still before all of that. It didn't exist. Pro Tools didn't exist. We were still recording on tape. But I developed software to create click tracks on the computer that I would just output and send them to tape if they needed a click track for the session.
This kind of reminds me, I don't know, do you know the story of Arnold Schwarzenegger when he's sort of moving for his career from being a bodybuilder to being a film star, which was his ultimate goal? I don't know if you know his whole coming up story. It's quite fascinating. Oh, yeah. And it kind of reminds me of the same thing, because what he ended up doing was setting up a bricklaying and masonry, fine masonry company, where he hired all his bodybuilding friends like Lou Ferrigno and all these other people. Right. And they had this ad in the LA Times that was all like, it was like European high fine masonry. And they're sort of going out and doing these jobs as these big, bulky dudes, you know, doing this fine like brickworks. And then there was a huge earthquake in LA. And so the combination of those two things, all of a sudden they had more work than they knew what to do. And he ended up hiring all of his friends. You know, it's just that perfect culmination of like, here's what we're doing. Everybody wants it. And now there's an additional event that just makes us more valuable than, you know, you couldn't make a strategic plan better than what just sort of ended up happening.
All of my work, all of it, was word of mouth recommendation from one friend to another. So if you go back, obviously, the whole community, like it is now, we all know each other. Everybody knows each other. And so you help each other out, you know, and people would have all these things that they needed, and I was the only person that could do it. Who else could come up with a click track, variable click track? Who knows about that? I learned it. That's what I went to school for. I studied 2 years of music editing using film clicks with punching holes in film. So I understand when all these composers are talking the film scoring language, I totally understood. And I said, oh, I just don't do that on my computer. When you need it, tomorrow. Okay, yeah, I'll do it right now. I'll run it over. I'll drive it over. And that's what happened over and over and over and over and over again until I was so helpful to these people that they started, when they couldn't do work because they were busy or they were sick, whatever, they would literally, they wouldn't give the work to me because they can't just hand it over, but they would tell the producer, this person is my protege, they will take care of you, and if there's any issues, they'll talk to me. And that's what happened dozens and dozens and dozens of times with dozens of mentors. Mm. That I was providing computer music editing services to. I ended up for, you know, so at first I was just like, oh, can I hang around? Oh, yeah, you're cool. Like, you know, but it ended up that function in the movie, music editor, it's the liaison between the technical and the composing, the writing the notes. The bird poop, as they said, called it back then. The bird poop, like people these days wouldn't even get that the analogy, but they call it chicken shit, bird poop.
Right.
So I was the liaison between the world of traditional editors, music editors, and film composers who were just getting their own computers. So I basically set up 12 composers first time using a computer.
Mm. In terms of what you would consider your first sort of big break, like were you able to step into actually doing your own work and own your kind of, or have some more agency as a film composer? What was that moment? Was there a sort of singular kind of moment when that happened for you?
Yeah, there were a couple, but the very first one when I said, okay, I think I got it. my first real gig was for the CBC. Why?
Because your dad
had been working there for 35 years at that point.
Right. Good old nepotism.
This is, you know, and he had buddies. He worked for the sports department. Graphics. He was the head of sports graphics is what his job became. And it was still before computers. So it was all doing it with film cameras, taking pictures of cutouts of paper, stuff like that, right? So my dad has a buddy who's a producer of the football games, the CFL. Is his buddy. And so he goes, oh, my son's in music. Hey, he can do your theme. And back then, that's all it took. It wasn't like, oh, can I hear something? No, that doesn't, who cares? He's my buddy. He's going to get the gig. I don't care whether he can write or not. That's not the point. That's back then, that's the way it worked.
Right.
Now it's like, ooh, you're my best friend, but, you know, I gotta take demos from 12 people to see, you know, I have so many people I have to decide. So,
yeah.
You know, we still have, I want you, but, you know, it's still by committee and you have to still prove that. Then no, back then, my dad goes, my son does music. And the producer goes, that's great. Here's $6,000. Do the theme. That's our budget. $6,000. I've never been paid more than $100 to do music. And that's why I consider that my first gig, because I got the gig. The theme music for the Canadian Football Network, which is a private company, and this producer went with the private company, went out of the CBC and created their own network, the Canadian Football Network. It was a network on TV just to play Canadian football games.
Wow.
And because of nepotism, I got the gig to do the whole score. And that was my first gig.
Amazing.
And I thought I'd won the lottery. Like, literally, the most I ever made was $100 doing music. And I get this gig, and it's $6,000. So all of a sudden, I was a big composer. I could hire, like, 5 musicians, conduct, be all big. And it's a young guy, which is, you know, back then, most of the old people were still around, and they were still writing stuff out. The CBC was the biggest employer at that time.
Right.
So that was my first gig. And so it all goes from there. I'm pretty good and I'm pretty smart. So I could always stay 2 steps ahead of everybody. I was never brilliant. I was never genius. But I didn't have to be. I still don't have to be. You just have to know what you're doing. That's it.
Yeah.
You don't have to be the best. You know, that's why I teach my new apprentices. Like, it's great if they do things that are the best, but it's not predicated on that. Your making a living is not predicated on you being the best. It's you getting the job done. That's it. And if you get the job done cheap, fast, and all those acronyms, you get the gig. In that equation, is it the best music gets the gig? Does that ever happen?
Right. Right. So when you're looking back on that whole period after you get your first gig at the CBC, what would you say is one of your fondest memories of a gig or of a series or anything that you worked on from that time where you were like, that was really meaningful when you look back now?
What I learned, just like what I learned when I was 7 years old with music theory, is everything. I'm so glad I learned that. Well, go to the future, and one of the best experiences I had with Mickey and Maribeth, finally, after 4 years, No, you stay at the office. We're doing a session. 4 years. I didn't go to a Mickey and Maribeth session for 4 years of apprenticing.
Right. And for anyone who doesn't know who they are, let's just back up the train and maybe you can sort of fill people in on who's the wonderful late Mickey now, Irby and yes. Maribeth Solomon.
They have a huge history in the Canadian music scene. Being part of their whole family is part of the Canadian music scene for many, 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 many years. And this is not just film. This is just the music scene in general. You know, bands, gigs, you name it. Films, TV, whatever. They were a huge part of that.
And Maribeth, of course, Maribeth now, of course, is known probably most for her theme to Schitt's Creek, which just won a CSA again. So, yeah, you were saying 4 years, you never get invited to a session, and all of a sudden.
They needed a piano player.
Wow.
And they knew how, it wasn't about whether I could play or not, they knew I could play. They heard me every day. I rented a space in their studio for 6 years. They heard me every day. I was in their basement for 6 years, renting it. So they heard me. They knew what I could do. But still, it had nothing to do with whether I could go to a session or not.
Right.
But one day, one of the keyboard players couldn't make it or something. Or they needed an extra one. Who knows? But it turned out that I was the best choice out of everybody in the city. At that particular gig, I was the best choice. And they said, hey, do you want to just you know, come over and maybe play the piano? They're so careful about the people they bring into their fold that even their main assistant over 4 years had to be sheepishly waited. I wonder if I should do that or not. Well, I know why they did, because other people that I mentored with, I did some like really like dumb kid things, like, you know, eating the main person's food and stuff like that. The star, you know, it's like eating the star actor's meal in your event.
Wow.
I did stuff like that. And so, of course, that's why they're very hesitant about their sessions. Very closed, very closed. You don't even look. Like, don't even look in there.
Wow. So to get invited into that fold must have felt pretty amazing.
Scary.
Yeah.
And I took some heavy backlash from the other musicians.
Oh.
Who the hell are you? What do you mean you're playing the piano part? That's the main part.
Wow.
What do you mean I'm playing the string pad? And this kid's going to play the piano part? And of course they wouldn't say that to Nicky and Maribeth. But they said it to me.
Wow.
And I dealt with years of that. And that's what a lot of people don't know. They say, oh, you played with Mickey and Maribeth for a long time. Yes, but you don't know the backstory of me and the musicians and what was implied to me and said to me. All of those musicians, by the way, I ended up hiring a lot.
Okay.
So I can say stuff like that. But the thing, but at the time, but you can imagine, you know, the same people in the same sessions over for 2 years, and all of a sudden this kid's coming in for the piano. And I'm not even that good compared to them. I'm obviously not as good as them. They were brilliant.
Right. Players. Yeah.
I'm a kid with a computer who helps a whole bunch of composers. And I'm in there playing piano.
Yeah, pretty guarded system. I imagine that there was a lot of, just like, you know, puffing chests and elbowing people out of the way for that kind of stuff. It was a pretty competitive scene, I'm sure.
I'm sure it's still that way, in L.A. and in circles. You know, there are far fewer big live sessions like that anymore. But the dynamic, it's crazy what you learn and who you meet through the process.
Yeah.
And that's why I say, you know, I learned from my mentors, man. I learned so much. Not because they actually taught me anything, but just by being there. What I learned about the music business when I worked for a company that wouldn't even let me in the session for 4 years.
Right.
Not even to deliver coffee. You can't come through this door. It's a secret door, and no one comes in here.
Wow.
That's what I learned. And that, I learned why they did that, and now respect why they did that.
Right.
And take those concepts I learned from that and go, oh, now I know why. After I take the lead actor's sandwich. Yeah. I learned that there's a reason why you just don't let any ragtag whoever come to your sessions.
Yeah. Well, you let this ragtag come and be in your session in 2007. You know, I've been thinking about this a lot, you know, just in the few days leading up to this conversation, because that was a pretty formative part of my coming up. And, you know, as you're saying, like what you learn from mentors and how important that is and how it's so interesting. You talk a lot about, or you're talking a lot about, you know, what you're learning isn't necessarily the nitty gritty, like here's how to do this or here's how to do that. Or I learned this specific thing. You're just, it's that experience of being with someone who's pro, who's in the trenches and almost just hanging out and getting a sort of like along the way kind of education. I remember the first meeting we had, I walked into the studio and we ended up chatting for, I think, 3 hours. Wow. Just sitting on the couch talking about everything. And I think that's probably why you ended up going, okay, why don't you stick around for a bit? Because I was curious. I like talking. I like having conversations. This is why I do this. And then you took me on and I don't think I would ever go out and eat someone's lunch. I might've done that by accident, but I remember some of the first things we did and it was kind of a similar situation in a way. I didn't know anything about what it would take to be. I had no idea what I was in for. I really, like, I was thinking about, I wrote like a blog post shortly after the time that I spent with you. And I remember just the image of being like walking into a pool or like a swimming pool and you kind of leading me over to the deep end and just going, push. No water wings, no nothing. Because I remember one of the first jobs I ever had, we went out to your place. Not a Q Music. I would come and hang out and sort of just learn stuff. You'd be like, read all the books, play with the gear, do whatever you want. Here's the sessions. You know, just make yourself, just instate yourself take it in. Start just ingesting the vibe and what happens and listen to the conversation. Shut up. Don't say anything. You know, I would do spotting notes for you and all that kind of stuff. But I remember one of the heaviest things that I ever did was I came to you. So 2004, this is 3 years before I actually get this opportunity, which now seems like, wow, that's no time at all. 2004 is I decide this is what I want to do. You know, I've played in bands. I was a musician for a long time, but now I've decided, no, I want to be a film composer. That's it. This is what I'm doing. 3 years later, I'm in your place. And you're like, I'm music directing for the Canadian Aboriginal Music Awards. And we've got all these charts that we need to do up. And the thing is in like half a week. So we need to do all these songs. You had this amazing way of cueing the orchestra, like your onstage orchestra, your MDing, where you'd have these flashcards and you just like put up a flashcard and it would say something that would be like this track from whatever the artist's nominated piece of music was. And it would be in this style. So it'd be like this guy's tune, but in a rumba or this in a punk rock style. And they just like, they look at it and go, okay, got it. Boom. And they'd be in like 1, 2, 3, 4. And you said, okay, I need to use, like, how good are you with your ear? And I said, my ear's really good. I could do takedowns, no problem. But I wasn't used to charting. I never really charted in my life.
Yeah.
And I don't think I said that to you. I think I just kept my mouth shut and went, oh, this is going to be a nightmare. He's going to kick me out of here right away. And I remember because the charts weren't easy too. They were like, I want everything on one line. I want the drums, like anything that's important. So I want the lead line. I want all the changes. I want even the, like there's a drum fill or this. And you just kind of like quickly ran me through the way you wanted to have it charted. And I was just like, okay. And I was horrible at it. And you just kind of looked at you came over like an hour later. I'd done all the takedowns. I knew the changes and the melodies and everything, but I couldn't put it onto, I couldn't do the chicken shit, you know, the dots on the page. I was just struggling. And you looked at me like, do you know what you're doing? I was like, I don't have a whole lot of experience. Like, never mind. And you're kind of like, just took it and you just ripped. I remember just watching you rip through these things. And I'm like, okay, note number one, big hole in your game. Learn how to chart. God damn it. You know, it was that kind of stuff. And then the other thing I remember is the car rides. That was probably, that's what I always come back to because we spent so much time in the car going from place to place. You had 1,000 different things going on. I remember one of the first things you ever did was you jumped in the car and went to Long McQuaid. You were looking into your account. What's going on? What am I getting? What am I waiting for? What am I, you know, where are my accounts at? Then we go back and forth in your place out in the country. And then we go to the different studio, back to Q Music, and then all over the place. And all of the time, all these hours, and I come and sleep at your place when we were doing this one movie together and we're sort of like crash composing this film. All the times in the car would be these little moments where you'd look at me and you'd say this like, it was like a Zen Cohen where it was like wisdom from Donald. And it would be things where I'd be like, I kind of know what he means, but I also don't really know what he means. And it was so interesting because the first time I was ever exposed to this idea that pros talk differently. There's a different language. And when you get it, you get it. It's kind of like what you said, like what, you know, what it, how to speak or how to be in these areas. And you're not going to be led into that behind the secret door until you show that you know what it's like. What were some of the things? I remember one of the first things you said, like every morning when I wake up, I have more opportunities than I know what to do with. I've got 10 things in my inbox that I'm going to have to say no to because I've got this network. And it was like, you painted this picture of the spider web of all these different things that are interacting constantly. And it was this thing was like, I set it up and I put this intention out there and then things come back to me. And that's how this all works. And I remember going, that is not at all what I thought this would be about. I didn't think it would be this kind of ephemeral. And it's true. Right. To this day, I go, you know, that's what it is like. I don't know how I go day to day. I don't know how the gigs come to me.
Did it work somewhat?
Oh, yeah. Well, no, you know what? It wasn't about pragmatic things. It wasn't like, here, do this and this and this. It was like, have this attitude about stuff. Think about the world. For me, my idea about potential, my idea about what was possible was tiny. It was this tiny little thing. And you were like, it's like this. It's way beyond what you're thinking. Your thinking is very small. These magical, impossibly large things are what you should be shooting for. You know, and then just very specific, like the way you would go around and spend money on ideas and people and projects. You'd be like, this interests me. I'm going full speed ahead. I don't know where it's going. You would even say that. I was like, I don't know where this is going to end up. I remember what was some of the other things you said? I remember one time you said something that was kind of stuck with me. It was like, think about Babar. This is a story I tell people all the time. It's like when you're, you know, you can think about gigs two ways. You can think about like, what do I want to do artistically? What do I want to do, you know, just in terms of the shape of my career. But if you're thinking purely strategically, getting a big kids show is one of the smartest things you can do. Because look how long Babar's been on the air. By that time, we'd had the conversation about what back-end royalties look like and what that can mean if you get the right show. And you said, look how long that's been on the air, you know, decades. A little thing, and it's all everywhere in every language. It's evergreen. Kids don't care about what's cool and what's not. It's always playing everywhere on some station on the earth for decades. Imagine that guy never has to work again. I was like, wow, wow. Another thing you said to me, whenever I make music, it's like I'm printing money.
Oh, yeah, you said that.
And it's like, and you say that kind of like, it sounds, you know, this is the thing. You had this, like, you had this swagger. You were like, this is the big idea. And it wasn't like going to be true in every case. And it's always going to be like this, but it was just like, this is one way to look at it. And it's like a hyperbolic kind of idea. You always had this kind of like, another thing you said, like, don't read the trade magazines, like don't read Future Music, don't read Sound on Sound, because that's for people who want to be in those positions. People who are serious, they don't have time for that. Because that's the dream. They're selling you a dream. They're selling you the thing you want. They're not selling you anything useful. And it's like, you didn't mean don't ever read it. You just meant like, don't think that that's the real deal. You know?
Right.
And I just, that whole time, I just remember thinking, like it's the big things I took away from that. And that's the thing I kind of like, I hope that I tell people now is, you know, there is this huge potential. Don't hem yourself into a small way of thinking. Think about that network and that spider web of opportunity. Think about how you can put energy out into the world that somehow comes back to you. And the idea of throwing yourself in the deep end, that was the other big thing. Over and over again, when we were working together, I'd be put in these positions where never in my life did I actually feel before, like literally physically getting up and wanting to run away. Like, I just want to be away from this situation. I feel I'm so humiliated and this is so awful because I don't know what I'm doing. But you know, in that process, I was like, okay, now I got to work to get there. And I just, now I seek those opportunities. I put myself in challenging positions over and over again because I know I'm going to learn so much faster and I'm going to I'm going to get to someplace really great. And you know, it's funny because you think things are going to be so bad in that moment and then things are never quite that bad. And you can take a punch. Like, that's the other thing. You learn, like, it's never going to be as much of a nightmare as you think. So, I have a lot to thank you for in terms of your mentorship in those days. And I think it was funny because I was actually going to be with Eric Kadesky and Nick Dyer, both of those guys I'm super big friends with now. But they actually interviewed me and said, I don't think you're the right guy for us. And I was like, it was heartbreaking. I was like, oh, really? Oh, okay. I don't know how I failed that. But you were the perfect guy to be with, because it was always so, like, it was just so interesting. And one of the things we ended up doing at the end of that tenure, when I was doing all the film stuff and everything else, was I helped you when you were setting up Musidium.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And my wife, Susanna, and I, we actually sort of helped you. You had some other thing you need to deal with. And we were sort of helping design the space, like where were things going to go and what was going to go here. Wow. And sort of like you had the main part, like sort of figured out, but you're like, I want to like, how is the flow going to go? Where is this pedestal going to be? So I want to talk about that, because that is such an, that was such another magical, interesting idea that you had, which was this place where, you know, you would house these beautiful instruments, unusual instruments, or uncommon in Toronto anyways, instruments, and then eventually became a performance space. What was that? What did Musidium mean to you?
It's so funny, because the way you want stories to go, you want to have this nice package that, oh, this was my vision and this was what I did to do it. But the reality is that that's not the way things happen.
Right.
Anything, no matter how big or small the project is, it happens. First of all, you don't know what's happening, like for the first like third of being there. You're not even realizing that it's anything. So at that point in time, it's nothing. It's literally a manifestation of an idea. That's
right.
It.
Right. Yeah.
You look back, you go, wow, Musidium is known for this, as an article, a star, blah, blah, blah. That's all looking back. At the time when you're doing it, it is literally just an idea that you, oh, well, let's try this. Like, oh, there's a person down there that can help, let's do that. That's what it looks like. So if you want to know what Musidium would look like upon its inception, it's just couple ideas I think would be cool, and maybe try something here. It's so slow. It's not an instant. That's why I hate writing grants. I hate writing grants because you have to put it into a capsule and say, here, this is what I want to do. Give me money 2 years from now. Right. I can't do that.
Yeah.
Because it goes against what I just told you.
Yeah.
It goes against that. You can't just go, it feels like I should do this. I don't know why. I think I should incorporate food into this project for some reason. I don't know why. But you try to do that with the Canada Council to try to get like 10 grand, forget it. You have to say 2 years from now, I think there's going to be the, you don't, like, especially ridiculous. Like, think about the people who applied for grants before the pandemic. Can you imagine how their, what their proposals, how absurd they must look right now?
Yeah.
If you look back at those grant proposals that happened like 4 months before the pandemic hit. And of course, you know, everybody is pretty resilient about, you know, oh, well, of course it's different, because who would have known this would happen? But what happened with the pandemic and what's happening with it is no different than what happens to us in our careers all the time.
Yeah.
It really is exactly the same. And if you are in that mindset that no matter what happens, you just make it work by using your brain, then it kind of explains how Musidium started. I didn't write a proposal, a grant. It wasn't a 3-page synopsis of what I think it should be. I went up there. The building said, hey, there's a space free. Are you interested in it? I said, yeah, sure. I'm not sure what I would do with it yet, but yeah, I'll take it. And so the first, I paid for, like, you know, rent in this building is, it's hard to get into this building, but when you do, the rent is very reasonable. Mm-hmm. So I gave it, I said 3 months. So I put a black curtain over the glass front door for 3 months. And slowly I would take the curtain down and hang a weird instrument in it and then cover the back, like kind of like a display.
Right.
without saying what it was going to be. There was no name museum. The word, the name museum was not invented yet. It was just like, so I rented this place for 3 months. Usually when someone rents a space, you know, it's built in 2 weeks because they sort of got to make, have to start making money. But that's not the way this started. So I said, I'll figure it out. And I'm sure you were there during that time when it was nothing, not a museum. It was just a, close that window. I don't want anybody to see. And then we'd be in there like screwing around with stuff. And I think it was about 3 months of that. It wasn't a quick thing where it's like, hey, move everything in. We got to be open for business in a week. It wasn't like that. And so I literally had no idea what it was going to be. I had to see. I just had to try it and see what seemed to feel right. And when you think like that, you can't get money in the traditional ways, like, you know, grants or banks and things like that. So I see business as an improvisation, like a jazz gig. You do a jazz gig, you don't even know who's going to be playing the gig.
Yeah.
And you barely know what songs you might be doing. And you don't talk about it until you're on stage. That's how I live my life. That's how I live. That's how I do my business. And people say, you can't do business that way. Well, show me that you can. Because I've had a lot of people who are in business who had advised me and said, this can't work.
Right.
You can't do that. I have a partnership with the studio that we've never discussed anything on business. And the person I'm in business with is not really my friend. I respect him to the end of the earth. But I wouldn't call him up to go have a beer.
Right.
And we've been working for 25 years and we've never discussed business. We're partners in the studio and we have never had one conversation about business. No word of a lie.
It sounds to me...
mutual respect.
It sounds to me too. I mean, it's interesting you say you think of life and business as an improvisation, and that's actually a really good description. I always thought of you as a person who is constantly running a bunch of experiments that you don't necessarily even know what the thesis is yet. You don't know what the end result might be at all. And it's really just based on an interest. And you're like, and I think that why this works for you maybe is because you're not interested in the same thing that other people are interested in. You're not saying this needs to be profitable in this and this way. And these are the benchmarks for what I'm going to consider a success or a failure. Because, you know, when you look at Musidium, you had very specific ideas about how you wanted that to look and who you wanted it to serve. And then when you turned it into a performance space, there were very specific rules and ideas about what kind of performance space, what was going to be allowed, what was not going to be allowed. You know, you didn't care, it seemed, maybe you did, but you were just going to stick with your guns. Whether people liked it or not. And there was like, no, this is different. This is not like going to the bar or going to any kind of venue.
Because part of the equation is the imbalance and the not knowing. That's part of the equation.
Yeah.
It has to be that. That has to be in it for the gig to be good.
Right.
The analogy of the jazz gig is very much so. Like, you have to... you cannot have a... 10 rehearsals and play the same songs over and over again the same way if you're going to have a good jazz gig.
Yeah.
How do you have a good jazz gig? You hire some great players, you kind of tell them what you're going to do, and you say, well, here's where we're going to do it. And all of a sudden, everybody comes together and they record it and it becomes the biggest thing ever, like Bill Evans Live at the Village of Vanguard or whatever.
Yeah.
Just a normal gig, which becomes one of the biggest... jazz records ever, because of that thinking, that way I'm thinking of life, of business. I treat business and life the same way as a jazz improv.
How does fear play into that? Like, and I'm thinking specifically about the idea of like these ventures where risk is involved. If you're playing an improvised gig, things can go wrong. If you're running a business, you could lose money or worse. How do you think about that, or how do you compartmentalize?
This is very simple. Rule number one, don't do anything where you're going to die.
Okay.
That simple.
Yeah.
The second rule is do the gig with people that are insanely smart, insanely normal, insanely capable of figuring out on their feet. Drop in the middle of the desert and they'll figure out how to survive.
Right.
They'll figure out how to, you know, take the self out of the water and drink. Get those people in your circle.
Yeah.
And then if your plan, okay, you're not risking anything where death is imminent. So you don't have to worry about that, right? So you'll live to see another day, no matter how bad it goes. But it won't go bad. Why? Because you only have people involved who can figure it out. Who can, you know, ooh, they lost their left hand, so they just play with their right hand. But they only play the good notes. Like, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
The gig's still going to be good if you have people who know how to do that. You can't get some person that's practiced every single jazz standard and learned everything, and all of a sudden they lost their hand and they can't play a damn thing.
So the idea is that, you know, there's two parts of it. You're mitigating a certain amount of risk, and then you're saying the risk you think exists doesn't actually exist the way you think it does.
It doesn't exist if you have the right people.
Right.
No, it is risky if you have the wrong people.
Yeah.
You know, I've learned my lesson with that, surrounding myself with the wrong people.
Yeah.
You surround yourself with the wrong people, they'll push you over the cliff. You got to have the right people.
The Quincy Jones rule again.
Yeah. They have to have your back, and they have to be brilliant in terms of being able to work on their feet, deal with whatever.
Yeah.
Oh, the piano's at you. What am I going to do? Oh, but this octave sounds all right. Oh, just play on this octave. You got to have that thinking.
Yeah.
Because if you have the other thinking, it'll go south.
Yeah. That's certainly very applicable to the whole world of scoring the screen, where that's basically your job more or less on every single gig, is to be a person who can figure it out on their feet. You know,
that's
something
right,
goes wrong.
That's right.
You know what? You can't tell your client you're not going to deliver. That's just not an option. You got to figure this out.
Like, the producer changed, or someone says that someone else is in charge now. And,
yeah.
Oh, their idea. Now the actor wants a whole different thing. Why is the actor saying so? Oh, because he just put $2 million into it.
Right.
Like, you have to be able to work on your feet.
Yeah.
Not just, it's extra hard in the film business, but it's what you do in life.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you have that attitude every day when you wake up, then nothing can happen. You work on the death stuff and make sure that you're basically like 99.9%, that's not going to happen. And the rest, you just surround yourself with people that are smart, that use their brains and have a bit of talent and can work on, can do stuff no matter what happens. Make the best of it.
Mm. Yeah. 2009, 2 years after I spent my 6 weeks with you, that was so formative, you were playing live keys with Derek Miller, and an event happened that probably was in the top, I would say probably three, if not the top thing that changed your life forever.
Yes. Yes.
Tell me about that moment.
Well, in case you don't know the story, it's simple. I overworked myself. I had underlying health issues. I performed on stage and dropped dead in the middle of a gig. There wasn't much medical help around. Doesn't matter why, but there wasn't. And so it looked like I wasn't going to make it. When everybody finally realized after 10 minutes what had happened, that I had a massive stroke. Looking back, I know why. I hadn't slept in 4 days.
Wow.
I never touched a drug in my life, but it was like I was a drug addict who hadn't slept for 4 days.
Wow.
It's like that.
Yeah.
So I overworked myself and just, I didn't have a limit. I thought I could do anything. I could stay up one day, stay up 2 days, to 3 days, just stay up 4 days. I can stay up a week. Hey, I can have stress. I could go do a gig and not tell the artist I'm performing with I'm going to Europe to play, do a film gig for 2 days, and I'm going to come back and they won't even know. I won't even come. The stress added on to that, I know why it happened to me. But nothing explains why I'm back.
Right.
I had the luck of saying winning the $50 million main lottery 3 times in a row. There is a minuscule chance that could happen, but it doesn't explain my coming back as a better person than ever.
And you were in a coma for how long?
I'm not sure. I haven't even looked into it. Anywhere from 3 days to 3 weeks.
Right. I remember it being in the order of 3 weeks, as I recall. Yeah, it was weeks. It wasn't days. Yeah. And when you came out of that coma, you had lost a considerable amount of brain function.
Functional brain function, I lost about 90% of it.
90%. 90%. So speech.
You could talk to me.
Yeah.
The stroke I had did not affect my speech.
Okay.
Well, not much. It did. I did slur for a few years.
Yeah.
But it wasn't. Some people with strokes really have aphasia. Like it sounds like they had a stroke as soon as you start talking. I don't have that. It takes a while to say, oh, maybe as somebody I'm not even going to mention because it's not for that. That's the kind I had.
And huge amounts of memory loss too. Long-term memory was gone. A large degree.
Well, at first everything was gone.
Everything
but
was
I
gone.
Realized,
right.
I realized the long-term memory is the heart. It is the most solid memories I have.
Okay,
they're all in there.
But they were just not accessible.
They're not accessible because of the kind of stroke I had. Disconnections happened between synapses in my brain, which allowed access to those memories.
Right. Because you were also clinically dead for what? 17 minutes.
I'm not supposed to be alive.
I mean, brain death happens after 7 minutes. I remember that from lifeguard training.
There was no paramedic on site.
Oh, wow. Wow.
That means it took the time it took from the paramedics to come from the hospital to the venue.
Yeah.
I was dead for that long.
Was anyone performing CPR?
Nobody.
Nobody did CPR even. So you didn't have blood flowing to your brain for 17 minutes.
Yes. Now, I believe someone did try.
Okay. Yeah.
But, and I can talk about this now because all lawsuits are now passed.
Yeah.
But the venue did not have the required paramedic at the side of the stage during a major performance of more than 300 people or whatever the law is.
Right.
They didn't have it.
Yeah.
Their solution was, the guy running the ice cream truck knows CPR. He has a certificate, so that's good enough.
Yeah. Yikes.
Chances are it's going to be fine.
Yeah, chances are. Wow.
So that guy who knew it didn't even know what was going on because the band didn't even know what was going on.
Wow.
For several minutes.
Wow.
The lead singer thought I was just screwing around. It took like 5 minutes just for everybody to realize what was happening. The crowd thought it was part of the act.
Wow.
And why do I know this? Because I have a video of it.
No kidding. Wow.
5 minutes after it happened, I have brilliant relatives. You know, one of my relatives, upon hearing it, the first thing they did was look for a video because he knew it would be important to have for whatever reason.
Oh my God.
And now the only reason is that I get to see what happened.
Yeah.
But I have a video of me falling. It's pretty interesting.
So my memories of visiting you. So I came with Ron Korb, our mutual friend Ron, to visit you at the hospital. And Ron thought, why not bring Donald some music? Because they had a little piano in the sort of like auditorium of the hospital. And we'll bring Ron. Donald hasn't really done much music in this while. Maybe it'll help him with his brain and, you know, maybe stimulate something. And I remember you sat down and you were sort of, it was like you'd aged 30 years. You were an old man. You were waddling along and kind of confused. And you sat down at the piano and you were sort of kind of making a few notes here and there, but not, it just seemed everything was as a mystery. So Ron put up this music, very simple kind of, you know, I think it was like, it was left hand, right hand were playing the same thing. And you looked at it and you started reading and playing, and it was actually, the intervals were correct, but you were playing it a third transposed up. And everything you were doing was like transposed. It was very interesting. God. And then another memory I have is I was recording something. I was sort of creating
By the way, I can't sight transpose.
Whoa, that's interesting. So that was just a weird, okay. Then the other memory I have is I was recording something at Q Music in the control room. And we were just doing some sample library stuff. And you were came into the room and you were just sort of, you know, puttering about, and you have all your LPs, or I don't know if they're still there anymore, but at the time you still had all your LPs.
They moved to my Barry office, my Barry office.
Right. So you had all these LPs, and you were going through these LPs, all your 70s records, you know, your beloved 70s records.
Yeah.
And you knew the artists, you knew the records very well. There was no confusion about what these were. And you would pull these records out, maybe some classic Chicago record or a Beatles record.
Yeah.
And you'd look back at us and you looked at Gary, the engineer who, you know, you've been working with for so long. And you would look at Gary and like, is this my record? And Gary would be like, yeah, Donald, that's your record. And you'd be like, wow, this is really, this is mine. And you'd be like, yeah, that's your, these are all your records. And you're like, oh, okay. And you put the record back, you get another one out. And it was another class. And you'd be like, is this record mine too? I'd be like, yeah, Donald, these are all your records. And you just couldn't believe it. You were like, it was like watching a kid having 16 Christmases at the same time. Where like one record after another was just like, this is amazing. What was the road to recovery? What did that look like for you? How, I mean, it's been 10 years now. And when we chatted before, you said, you know, you're about 95% back, 90, like high 90s back.
Very high 90s. Very high 90s. There are a couple of things that happen, but they're so minor.
Yeah.
Yeah, they I don't even count them.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I can't even imagine what that would have been like, you know, like that, the vehicle through which you move through life and the windshield through which you see and the instruments you use to gauge where you are and what's happening. They're not giving you proper information anymore. What does that look like? How did that feel? And what did you do?
You know, you described, you know, with our talk here, you delved into like what made me when I was like young and through college, et cetera, et cetera. Exactly the same thing.
Hmm.
It's another big improvisation. And I'm on my third kick of the can.
Yeah.
That's literally how simple it is. I didn't plan to revive Museum and make it a concert venue. I said, literally, all in my head was like, oh man, my memory's really bad. Maybe this will help me if I run these shows. I'm not going to have anybody help me. I'm going to do it all myself. Ended up taking 3 years.
Right.
I thought it was going to take 3 months.
Oh, wow.
And it would be gone. I was trying to figure out how to close the whole thing down. But I was doing, oh, my brain's getting better. I haven't screwed up yet, so maybe I'll try it one more time. Huh. I'm screwed up a couple of times. And people were, I think most people knew my story, so they were very, you know, they weren't too hard on me. But it's just a big improvisation. It's like, okay, it's the piano player shows up and half the piano's out of tune. That's what happened with my brain.
Wow.
I showed up at the gig, looked around at my stuff and said, half of my brain's out. How do I deal with it? It wasn't this, oh my God, my world's falling apart. It's like, oh, just play this octave then.
Right.
And that's what it looks like. It's a big improvisation over 10 years. I did the big thing, and now I'm just like, you know, getting rid of the little crap. It's very good. Life is great.
Do you think that music was a vital part in that recovery? Do you think it would have been, you think your recovery would have been more difficult if you weren't a musician, if you didn't have access to music?
I can't answer that question because music has been me since I can remember.
Right.
I've always related life to music. That's how I got through life.
Mm.
All started, I didn't tell you what, I told you how I started my professional career, but I didn't tell you how I started music.
Okay.
As a person. I started music when I was 2 years old. My mother was an amateur musician and a music scholar. She got her degree in music, so she knew at least that much about it. So she, as a mother, I have a few things that I remember of her. When I was that young, when I was 3 years old. One is her cleaning out my ears. So I'd lie on her lap and she'd spend half an hour with a bobby pin pulling wax out of my ears.
With a bobby pin? Oh my God.
Yeah.
Ooh.
That was one of the memories of two. The other one was my mother singing folk songs out of the American Songbook.
Okay.
She knew every one of those songs and she sang them to me and taught, didn't teach me per se, but she would say, oh, let's sing this song. And I learned the entire American Songbook.
Wow.
And that book, it was called The Fireside Book of Folk Songs. It's all the American folk songs, all the real, you know, standard ones. A huge chapter of Negro spirituals. My mother knew every single one of those songs and taught and sang them. And that's the reason I was able to incorporate into society as a non-immigrant, just a Canadian kid, that although I looked different than everybody else, I was not ever treated differently because of my mom and her singing the American songs.
That's amazing.
And at that time, Canadians wanted to be American. A lot of them still do.
Yeah.
Especially in the music business, everybody wants to move to LA. No one's happy with just being Canadian closer. They dream of the day they're going to go to LA and score the next Spielberg movie. That's what happens. Well, that's what happened, you know, when I was young. We didn't want to be Canadian. We want to be American.
Right.
It's kind of the same thing, but you know, but that's really the focus. Mm. So that's when I started music. That most important time was when my mom sang Negro spirituals to me and taught me them. Because it wasn't anything then. It was just it's my mom's voice.
Right.
For years she was
singing. No context. Yeah. Huh.
She would just open that book and say, oh, this is a good one. Let's sing this one. That in that book include all the Christmas carols. So I learned all the basic Christmas carols from that book. You know, she'll be coming around when she comes. When I was three, I knew that song. None of my friends have ever heard of that, probably until they were teenagers. But to me, it was part of me. There was food, there was my mom singing to me, and that was it. And a couple other things, which I'm too embarrassed to say. No, there's no point.
So when we had our chat before, you, one of the wonderful things you said is you said you've done everything you wanted to do in life. You've had three kicks of the can, and you you said, you know, I think all of my bucket list is pretty much crossed off. There's nothing really that I want to do still. And now you said one of your biggest joys is just mentoring other people and helping other people sort of, you know, figure things out. What does that look like for you? How do you, what is it? What's your focus in mentoring? Do you still have the same style that you had with me? Is it still about exactly the idea of running experiments, you know?
What you've described to me of what happened with you is not changed an iota. Mm. I wasn't mentoring anybody for at least 5 or 6 years. And I finally got reacquainted with someone who I'm mentoring now. She's my main apprentice. Mm. And she's a relative. She's a niece through marriage. She's basically my niece.
Okay.
And I've embraced. And that all the stuff I'm doing now is with her as an artist, and it's going really, really well.
Oh, that's amazing.
So that's half of it. The other half, I've twins. They're 10. So like, there's a lot of ahead.
That's amazing. What other kind of projects are you working on now in terms of like your own personal musical projects, or are you recording anything or working on any shows?
I've been doing it for so long that the act of writing is literally I've tried everything. I've done it already. I don't get much joy out of it. It's not new to me.
Mm.
Like I've just done like finished 5 films this year with my partner, writing partner, Jim Gelser. And it's kind of like, we get together and we have lunch and we spend like a bit of time doing the music, because it's like, I can do it in my sleep. I know exactly what needs to be done and I do it. Mm-hmm. Blah, 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 blah. I think you were around when I did a couple demonstrations of improvising the score, and basically that's the score is 90% done.
Yep. Oh yeah, absolutely. So, we work. Yeah.
That's still the way I am, even more so. If I've done it before and I don't have to do anything interesting, like it's one thing when they say, "Hey, I want to take something all really interesting," but they never ask for that. I only get hired to do the things that people I know I can do, which I can do in my sleep. So
yeah,
that part of music, and I don't listen to much new music.
Yeah.
You know, I keep up by, you know, watching YouTube and, you know, seeing what they use as a library music and stuff like that. It's very peripheral, very peripheral. It's all about mentoring my kids, about cooking.
Yeah.
About my friends, my current friends. And just helping as many people as possible and living life. That's it. Because like I said, the concept is I've done everything.
Yeah.
So it's all bonus.
Yeah. And because it's all a big giant improv, maybe, you know, you'll come up with a new riff at some point and be like,
I'm sure I will. And while, you know, I'm doing this thing with my apprentice, since COVID, I've set up the streaming studio.
Right.
And I've talked a lot about it. People don't actually know that I've actually been working on it, and I just finished it 3 days ago.
Oh, amazing.
It all works. I tested it, troubleshooted it. It sounds fantastic. There are 5 cameras. The sound is studio quality. I can mix on the fly. I can have recording sessions in here. It's crazy. Whatever I've like yapped about, it's real and it's done.
So when we see the lights dim, we'll know you flipped it on.
People are going to just, you know, I mean, I'm not going to have a schedule the way I'm sharing it. There's no schedule.
Yeah.
It pops up. And some people see it, some people won't. Too bad if you don't.
Well, do you know where people can find it? Where can people find it?
Right now, I'm focusing all of my promo on Facebook.
Okay.
Because that's what saved my brain for the most part. It it stood in for my brain after my stroke.
Right.
So I relied on it 100% while my memory slowly came back. All Facebook does everything. Facebook, right, and online stuff. So so I use Facebook as my primary means of communication.
Yeah.
But I've set up my streaming system to stream on all platforms. So I haven't figured out whether I'm going to literally do it simultaneously or whether I'm going to stagger it, because each platform has different specifications. So I don't want to be average it out just to make it go on all platforms at once.
Sure.
So yeah. I'm doing a specific one for TikTok and we're focused right now on my the person I'm mentoring, her album release, her vinyl release.
Okay, right.
So that's what's happening at the moment. For me, it's getting my streaming, the ability, just like we've all gotten used to being able to pull out our phone and talk to whoever we want or look up anything we want, no matter where we are.
Yep.
We're used to that.
Yeah.
What I want to get used to is being able to just get up in the morning and go, oh, I'm going live. Hit live. Everything sounds great. Let's play some music for everybody. You know? That's what my goal was. And I've been celebrating over the past 3 days because it's done. And I'm going, it's done. So now I can stream. Now it's all my ideas can come forward. So I think the big thing now is going to be my streaming.
Amazing.
And it's going to include everything. And my apprentice is advising me on how to do things.
Okay.
Because there's two generations between us.
Right.
She's 19. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm 60 years old.
Right.
So what she can teach me about the way the world is huge.
So we're going to find you on TikTok.
Exactly. On everything. And she goes, why are you trying to be interesting and stuff? It's that you already are interesting. Just turn on the camera and start talking.
Oh, okay. Wow.
And I said, no. You don't know. She goes, that's what I would do. Like, I would watch that.
That's amazing.
So that's stuff like that. I'm going, okay, she probably has a point. So I'll start to change kind of how, you know.
Yeah, the new experiment's already running. Well, I'm sure we're all looking forward to checking that out and following you on your new adventures with streaming DQ24/7.
Yeah, and it's I'm not limiting who and what I talk about.
That's great. I love it.
And it could be myself, and it could be music or not music, and it could be cooking, and it could be anything.
Brilliant. And well, maybe you'll invite me on. I'd love to come and chat with you on.
You will certainly be on. You will certainly be on.
Do a tit for tat.
But
yeah?
It's not pre-recorded, so there's no chance to.
We'll do it live.
It's live. It
won't be the first time.
Live TV. So great. The idea is like live TV.
Great.
It's like you do your best, but you don't know what's going to happen.
Oh, yeah. It's the improv thing. Again, we're on the stage and we're making it happen.
And that's what I wanted to build here. It took me a year to build the studio because I wanted to cover everything.
Yeah.
I wanted, no matter what someone is or what they brought, I can have it.
That's amazing.
So I've secondary computers to FaceTime people if they want to go FaceTime, if they want to do anything. One of the most important things is that it always sounds like a studio recording.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's what I've worked out to the best of my capability.
Brilliant.
So
well,
that's
Donald,
the idea. Yeah.
This has been so much fun, so fascinating, and so great to go back down, the journey backwards in time. Again, I got to give you tons of props and thank you again. I have so much gratitude for the time we got to spend together and all the things you taught me. I'm glad to them all the time.
You filled in so much of what I did not remember.
That's awesome.
Like it's great. It's great to have that feeling of that I'm learning something still.
So good. Yeah. Well, thanks for taking the time and your this incredible journey and your candid answers and everything else. It's been super fun, and I wish you all the best with your future endeavors, including your streaming and everything else. And I can't wait to see what the next experiment for Donald Kwan is going to be.
Well, thanks a lot for having me. Honored that you asked. So,
my pleasure. All right, Donald, take care. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, ciao. Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, please consider showing your support by giving the show a 5-star rating and sharing the episodes with your friends and followers. The Screen Composer Studio is produced by myself, Adrian Ellis. Graphics and post-production assistance by Nick Grimshaw. Special thanks to our managing director, Tanya Dedrick, as well as Charlie Finley, Elizabeth Hannon, and Gagan Singh for their support. For more information on the SCGC, please visit www.screencomposers.ca and follow us online at Screen Composers, or reach out at tscs@screencomposers.ca.